All signs point to more intense rain and flooding in parts of the U.S. as the planet warms. If you live along the shore...
I think that those storms that come in, if you're in the path, you're in trouble.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, residents in coastal communities are coming to terms with climate change and their futures. Plus, kids sue Pennsylvania over carbon emissions and lose. And our forebears tried to bend nature to get their way, with mixed results.
Nothing about this was easy.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Many industries in the U.S. have cut their carbon pollution in recent years. But carbon emissions in the transportation sector are up. This week, the Obama administration set new fuel efficiency standards for heavy-duty trucks, vans, and buses to help address this. The rules would apply to everything from tractor trailers to school buses. Rebecca Williams has more on how the trucking industry's carbon footprint got so big.
Cars and trucks are the second largest source of the emissions in the U.S. that are causing climate change. Brandon Shutley is the project manager for Sustainable Worldwide Transportation with the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. He analyzed emissions data from the EPA from 1990 to 2014.
The main reason emissions are up in the transportation sector is due to increased emissions from medium and heavy duty trucking. And that, of course, we think is mostly due to increases in the actual use of medium and heavy duty trucks, things like construction, transporting goods and cargo around the United States. Most other parts that make up the transportation sector have stayed relatively flat during that time.
He says there's been more than a 30% increase in the number of light-duty vehicles on the road since 1990, but the emissions from those cars have stayed about the same.
Vehicles have just been getting more efficient during that time. Recently, we've hit some records in terms of new vehicle fuel economy, especially over the past 10 or 15 years. There's been major jumps in new vehicle fuel efficiency. So those gains, even though we've been also gaining quite a few vehicles, have led to a sort of stable performance in terms of emissions.
So what do we do about those heavy-duty trucks? Shutley says that's tricky.
For cargo, it's a little different. They traditionally get what we would generally think of as pretty poor fuel economy, 5, 6, 7 miles per gallon. But this is, of course, they're hauling tens of thousands of pounds of cargo around. So they've been increasing their cargo efficiency significantly during the same period we looked at. But the increase in just cargo operations moving around the country has led to the increase there.
He says his team is working on a study that's due out later this summer. They're looking at ways to improve the fuel efficiency of heavy trucks. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Of course, the Environmental Protection Agency's fuel efficiency standards for trucks won't start right away. They'll take effect over the next 10 years. There are more stories about climate change at our website, what's causing it, and how people are trying to fix it. That's all at AlleghenyFront.org. Baton Rouge residents were evacuated from their homes, and some even lost their lives in the recent flooding. Many observers across the U.S. thought two words: climate change. That's because climate models predict record-breaking rainfall and increased flooding for the South and other areas of the country. And there's no question that living by the ocean in the era of climate change is a risky proposition. As sea levels rise, homeowners are faced with few choices. Try to live with more and more flooding, try to protect their homes, or maybe pull up roots and head somewhere else. Sam Evans Brown, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's podcast Outside In, has this story about how, when it comes to making these wrenching decisions, coastal homeowners are basically on their own.
Nahant, Massachusetts is a rocky crescent moon of land out in the Atlantic Ocean just north of Boston. For its entire history, it's been at the mercy of the ocean. To get to the town back in the 1800s, you would cross a long, beautiful beach at low tide that connected it to the mainland. At high tide, you had to take a boat. These days, there's a 4-lane road built on that beach, and it sits just a few feet above high tide.
When the weather's good and in the summer, there is no prettier, nicer place. We have a private beach. We have a great view. The shipping lanes of Boston come right in front of our house. So all the big ships that come in, we can see, and I love it. I love my house.
Dave Lazaro is a retired bartender and a woodworker. The house he shares with his wife, Chris, is full of his carvings. It's kind of a comforting nautical clutter. He and Chris have lived on Willow Road in a house that at high tide is a stone's throw from the water for nearly 50 years.
I raised a family here.
Yeah. It's when Dave first moved here, did you tell him? He was the only one here all winter. Imagine that. They all lived in another town. It cracks me up.
I was a new kid on the block. Now I'm the old man on the block.
Waterfront property tends to be expensive because it's nice to live by the water. More than 120 million people live in counties on the United States coast. That's more than a third of the country. But anyone living on the water knows you get the beautiful summer days, but also the brutal storms.
The Mail of the Veer says that city is virtually underwater, about a third of it anyway, with high waters forcing...
There are two storms that people who've lived in Nahant for a long time talk about. The blizzard of 1978 and what everyone here calls the no-name storm in 1991. If you live anywhere else, you probably know it as the perfect storm. They made a movie about it.
When a storm comes in, the house shakes. You can literally feel it. And when those big waves hit the seawall, you can see movement. And the blizzard of 78, I had put plywood up in front of the windows, but when that got knocked in, there was waves carrying 4x8 sheets of plywood through the living room. And if one of those had hit, we would have had broken bones or been underwater.
As the seas rise, climate scientists predict devastation like this will become more and more common. Higher seas mean even a less powerful storm could push the tides up over Nahant's seawalls. Sam Merrill works with GEI Consultants, an engineering firm that designs coastal infrastructure.
The unfortunate thing is what we're really facing in so many of these coastal areas is what you can rightly call an extinction threat, the extinction of a community. And we don't know how to deal with extinction. It's not really a conversation in our public sphere.
He spends his days grappling with the enormity of this challenge.
You always have three options, fortify, accommodate, and relocate.
Fortify, accommodate, relocate. In other words, you can brace for things getting worse, you can try to adapt to live with the occasional flood, or you can abandon your home and flee. If this sounds like a simple choice, try spending some time in a place like Nahant, a place where real people are staring this in the face. When you do, each of those options gets a lot more complicated. Let's start with fortify, stay and fight. In a place like Nahant, you can see this just a few doors down from Dave Lazaro.
Hey, how are you?
That's where Ken Carangelo lives. He's single, no kids, and an executive at a big company in the film industry. He and his neighbors each own a section of an interlocking seawall. Carangelo's was built in the 90s after the perfect storm undermined the old wall. It's pretty imposing, tall enough that you can't reach the top of it from the beach, and even more concrete is buried under the sand.
And everything that's down there has a solid footing and Kevlar-coated rebar, so the salt doesn't get to it as much.
Ken bought this house in 2008, but he says the seawall cost the previous owners more than $200,000.
And the whole length of it, you know, it's the equivalent of building a sandcastle, and you kind of know what happens, you know, after a while. The ocean will do what the ocean is going to do. Depends how hard you want to fight it, I guess.
Plenty of people in coastal communities believe the federal government should help to pay to protect these sandcastles. And that's true in Nahant, too. One local official told me he thinks the Army Corps of Engineers should put a breakwater in Nahant Harbor. But Sam Merrill, the coastal engineer, says the cost of protection, especially if you're trying to protect every building from every storm in every community in the country, we're talking about spending billions every year for a century.
Well, I don't think it's feasible to protect every community.
So how about accommodating, the second option on our list, trying to live with the flooding, find ways to let the water flow in and out without causing so much damage? In Nahant, they're trying that too.
Seawalls can only do so much. You're not going to stop the Atlantic Ocean.
Enzo Baril is a local elected official. He grew up here, owns a garage in town, and can point out where all the families of mobsters used to live.
Right here.
He gave me a tour, pointing out newer houses that have been built to withstand moderate flooding. The biggest accommodation Nahant has made is to keep a lot of its low-lying areas out of development.
And it's open space, can't be built on, helps us keep our, you know, keep our costs down.
And there's even this pond at the low point of the town's golf course. When storms come, they put these giant bilge pumps in to drain the town.
So we actually drain the town down. Before we know there's a major event going to come, Northeaster, we drain it right down.
But despite the seawalls and the open space, Nahant has some of the worst flooding in Massachusetts. What's more, nearly 50 homes in Nahant are places called repetitive loss properties. These are buildings that have had more than two flood insurance claims in the past 10 years. Kind of the definition of having your home in a risky spot. These homes make up something like 1% of all buildings covered by flood insurance administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. But that 1% puts in nearly 40% of the claims. If you think of it in healthcare terms, this is kind of like the chronically sickest patients going to the doctor again and again. But the doctor can only treat the symptoms while the disease itself is just getting worse. But unlike healthcare, it does seem like the natural question is, when do you just give up on these homes? Ask families to move somewhere safer, higher up. Even Enzo Baril, a lifelong Nahanter, thinks there's a point after which you shouldn't get paid to rebuild a home in a spot like this.
Where do we draw the line? I don't know. I think that, personally, I think that once FEMA has paid you, and if they've paid for your home, you've lost it, because it's in a ridiculous spot, enough's enough. We have to just say no, because the country is paying for that now.
So, relocation. Just move. That third option on our list, maybe more than the others, seems so simple as a hypothetical. But in real life, it's not even close. Consider Dave Lazaro, the retired bartender who likes watching the ships go by. His home on Willow Road has been flooded 6 times over the past 40-some-odd years. He doesn't question that the seas are rising.
Storms are getting more intense. And there are places where once you can live, now you can't live. I don't think of Willow Road that way.
And that's the thing. Nobody feels this way about their own home, even if logically they know the odds.
Is this house going to be safe here in the next 25 years? I'm not sure about that, you know. Because I think that those storms that come in, if you're in the path, you're in trouble.
When you're talking about other people's houses by the sea, and how risky those are, it's much easier to distance yourself and look at the facts. When it's your home, the view gets blurrier. So this is where flood insurance comes in. The price that people pay should be a signal, a clue that sooner rather than later, you will be in trouble.
Do you guys think you could live here without flood insurance? Do you think that like you would take that risk?
No.
Yes.
See, even in one household, figuring out where and when to draw the line is complicated. The signal that flood insurance sends gets all mixed up in your love for your home. And that only gets messier the more families you include. Just as an example, many older, riskier properties covered by federal flood insurance are grandfathered in to getting artificially low rates. After Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy left the program $23 billion in debt, Congress tried to raise those rates. Coastal property owners reacted immediately, filling their representatives' inboxes and voicemails with complaints. Members of Congress, like then-Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu in 2013, fought to keep the subsidies.
This is a major bill that passed without the data necessary to use either compassion or common sense. Okay? Compassion and common sense.
Less than 2 years after the reform was passed, Congress watered it down, delaying some rate increases and eliminating others. Which means while insurance rates are rising for coastal residents, it could be another 10 to 15 years before many of them are paying what the private industry would consider a rate that truly reflects their risk. There is no clear message telling coastal homeowners whether they should relocate. Sam Merrill, the coastal engineer with GEI Consulting, thinks that without some sort of action, eventually many homeowners will be left holding the bag when their homes simply cease to be worth anything, or worse.
Generally, it's going to be bloody. The question is, can we help communities make it be a little bit less bloody? And I think so. None of the options are terribly good at this point. I mean, in many places, there's still whole communities there where, in fact, we may be past the point where anything makes financial sense.
Like millions of Americans in coastal areas, homeowners in Nahant have a really tough decision in front of them. Fight nature or give up your home. What you realize spending time in a place like Nahant is that none of their options are appealing or simple or cheap. It's the kind of situation that leads people to put off a real decision. But for people like those in Nahant who are struggling, there's also a deadline coming. It won't arrive suddenly, but it will arrive inevitably. For WBEZ, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
That story comes to us from WBEZ's Heat of the Moment series. For more of their stories about everyday life on a changing planet, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. In the early 1800s, Pennsylvania was in a hurry to ship goods across the state with one of its most abundant natural resources, water.
Technology maybe wasn't quite ready yet, but they made it work because nobody wanted to be left behind.
But did they, though, make it work? Coming up on the Allegheny Front, the short but winding history of Pennsylvania's canal system. Stay tuned. A few years ago, a high school student and environmental activist from Mount Pleasant in Westmoreland County sued Pennsylvania over its carbon emissions. The case was part of an initiative by a national group, Our Children's Trust, to get young people to demand their governments protect them from the threat of climate change. Ashley Funk's case failed, but a new suit was filed last fall to force the governor and state environmental regulators to make a solid plan to lower greenhouse gas emissions. In late July, a court threw out the case. They said Funk and other children in the suit don't have the right to compel Pennsylvania to take action based on the state constitution's environmental rights amendment, beyond what regulators are required to do by existing climate and pollution laws. Ashley Funk is now a college student majoring in environmental studies and engineering. She joins me from Mississippi, where her summer job is working on community development issues. So, Ashley, when you heard the court's recent decision, what did you think?
I was very disappointed. There was a recent victory in the state of Washington. The court essentially said that, yes, the regulators in the state of Washington need to prohibit climate change in order to meet the constitutional rights of these young people who were filing the suit. And so when we heard that, I was just like, really, really, Pennsylvania? Just because, I don't know, I was kind of riding this wave of these other victories, and I thought that that would have influence. But when I looked more into the decision that the court released, I was a lot more excited to push our case forward with an appeal because they did make some rulings that help our case.
Well, tell me a little bit more about why you were excited and what you hope will happen.
While they ruled that we needed to be realistic with the environmental rights amendment, they did determine that we all had standing, which means that what we were bringing up was valid and that we were affected by climate change. And they also ruled that the court had jurisdiction over the case. So the court are the ones that should be deciding this in the end. Even though they didn't allow the case to proceed, those were two big rulings in our favor that we can use as we move forward to appeal.
Now, Governor Tom Wolf has said that the state is going to move forward with the federal Clean Power Plan to reduce carbon emissions, even though that's been stalled by the Supreme Court. Does that have any bearing on your case?
Not necessarily, because what we want is Pennsylvania itself to establish a yardstick saying whether or not they're doing enough, because their constitution says they need to secure a healthy, clean environment for generations to come. We want them to have it in law what they need to do to make sure they are addressing climate change enough. And so even if they are using the Clean Power Plan, we want the state to also have its own law in case anything ever happens to the Clean Power Plan, which is possible. And we want to have that law within Pennsylvania. They essentially said Pennsylvania was doing enough to mitigate climate change, but they can't tell us the numbers. They can't tell us why. They can't tell us how much they're actually reducing their carbon footprint. And that's what we want, because we don't think that Pennsylvania is doing enough. And if they establish these limits saying Pennsylvania needs to do this every year in order to play its part in combating climate change, then the law would have to adjust to meet that.
So you're appealing, but even if the lawsuit doesn't ultimately succeed, do you feel like it's made a difference and that you've made a difference?
We moved far enough ahead the whole way to a hearing. So the DEP had to have people for, I think it was like 3 months, compiling this report, their argument, explaining why they were doing enough. And so they pulled it back to, like, in my opinion, outdated climate action plan that Pennsylvania had established. But I think that that process of having to go through their records, I think that that action itself is valuable. It's making people in the DEP question their actions. And we were able to bring a group of young people together to work on this case. We have 5 other plaintiffs. That has been really powerful, getting these younger people on board to fight through their legal rights for climate change. And I'm excited to see how this case can continue moving forward because of them and kind of inspire them, because I understand better how my constitutional rights can be used to establish legislation. And so that has been really powerful. And I think that I'll carry that forward for the rest of my life too, and the rest of my environmental career.
Now, I know you were busy with environmental activism in college at Wellesley and majored in environmental studies. How does the lawsuit and, you know, this most recent court decision influence how you see your future and what you want to accomplish?
I'm very interested in local level community development. Particularly, I'm interested in, like, water infrastructure for small communities. I plan on moving forward in rural development, and I especially want to do this in southwestern Pennsylvania. Like, diversifying economies, making it so that people don't have to rely on natural gas or coal to support their economy. At the same time, local community development work is really slow and on the ground, and it's not always that I feel like I'm making, like, these big strides to combat climate change. I want to be working on a bigger scale for climate action, because I think that this is an issue that is so pressing. We're already seeing the effects of climate change so significantly. Like, West Virginia just experienced that severe flooding. I really want to be addressing this. The lawsuit has given me the opportunity to work on both larger state and at times national scale while I'm doing the local community development work. And so I want to keep doing it for as long as the case survives and I'm young enough. I think it's like kids versus global warming, but I've been doing this since I was like 16 and now I'm 22 going on 23. So I'm not so much a kid anymore, but it works. Yeah.
That was the still young Ashley Funk. There's more on her lawsuit against Pennsylvania over carbon emissions and climate change at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. Say revolutionary technology, and maybe smartphones come to mind, or Facebook. But long before Mark Zuckerberg, canals were the big disruptors. They redrew the wilderness and remade the country's economy. In Pennsylvania, a great example of that transition is a National Park Service site in Blair County. On August 25th, the Park Service will celebrate 100 years. So Margaret J. Krause visited the Allegheny Portage Railroad and has this unlikely story of how canals helped create a gateway to the West.
Park Ranger Doug Bosley says he still kind of can't believe that Pennsylvania pulled it off.
Nothing about this was easy.
Bosley is showing me a stretch of track that runs uphill at a pretty steep slope for a railroad, a 6 or 7% grade. It was one of a series of tracks called the Allegheny Portage Railroad that stepped its way over Allegheny Mountain. It wasn't a huge hill, but at the time, it took some doing.
The locomotives weren't very powerful. A lot of them were only, you know, 20 to 30 horsepower. Your lawn tractor at home, more powerful than the locomotives at that time.
We're standing at the crest of what's now a quiet green hillside. But the Allegheny Portage Railroad National Historic Site was once part of a short-lived, revolutionary system that transformed Pennsylvania forever. Here's how it happened. The 1820s was a time of national expansion, fueled by American chutzpah.
Sort of the age of Jackson, the President Andrew Jackson, and sort of the everyman age. Everybody can rise up, no matter what station you started out in life. That was the can-do attitude.
As the U.S. border edged westward, there were greater opportunities to move raw materials such as timber from the west to the east and finished products back in the other direction.
But there was no practical way to do it.
That is, until the Erie Canal opened in New York in 1825. While it took 3 to 4 weeks to ship goods on pack animals west across Pennsylvania, it took just 10 days to send them on the Erie Canal. New York boomed, and Pennsylvania didn't want to lose out.
Technology maybe wasn't quite ready yet, but they made it work because nobody wanted to be left behind.
Enter the Pennsylvania Main Line of Public Works. That was the very formal name for a system of canals funded by the state to connect Philadelphia to Pittsburgh and on to points west. It was nearly 400 miles of inland waterways, with the exception of this 36-mile Allegheny Portage Railroad.
The surveyors came through, staked out the line where the railroad would be, and then the first work that was done was cutting a 120-foot-wide swath through the forest.
When the main line opened for business in 1834, it was like the Amazon.com of the 19th century. Suddenly, everyday people could afford to buy the things they needed and get them in a timely fashion. But these modern conveniences came at a cost. The most notorious instance of this was making the canal reservoir outside Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Turns out, one of the biggest problems of running a canal system is keeping enough water in there so boats can run even in dry seasons. So the mainline system dammed South Fork Creek to create the reservoir. It failed. Big. When it broke in 1889, the flood killed 2,209 people.
The respect for the power of nature and how man was changing the landscape, people really didn't think about that when they were making all of these changes.
Louis Quett is a hydraulic engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I spoke with him in his office in downtown Pittsburgh. He spends his days controlling water flow in local rivers, and he says the canal system of the 1830s continues to inform river traffic today.
And it is folly for us to believe that we can control nature, but it is certainly reasonable for humans to work with nature.
Today, few sections of the mainline survive, and none are used commercially. About 20 years after it was completed, the Pennsylvania Railroad purchased the whole system. While the canals may be gone, water is still how we move a lot of goods from point A to point B. Things like coal, farm produce, and petroleum products ply the inland waterways through the Army Corps' river system of locks and dams, which kicked off in the late 1800s.
We don't see an end to river navigation. You know, our roads are certainly already crowded, and a single standard barge holds as much cargo as 15 railroad cars or 60 semi-trucks.
So Quett says, leveraging the power of water might be an old idea, but it's one that still works in the 21st century. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
If you visited a national park or historic site like the Allegheny Portage Railroad this summer, we'd love to see your photos. Share them with us on Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.